We're in Mark 1, if you haven't been with us, and if you have a Bible, you might start turning in that direction. And as you're doing that, I just remember, how many of you can remember your first driving lesson? How many of you, that was like super memorable, or maybe you're trying really hard not to remember that, you've been repressing that. Just out of curiosity, how many of you had like a formal driver's ed class? Like some of you, how many of you the class was mom and dad or like an uncle? Or I'm in that latter category, and I very specifically remember the lessons that my father gave me. You have to understand, he grew up drag racing and loved all things cars, and we always had stick shifts, and so the lessons started. We went to Valley River Center in the parking lots at night, and I'm sure my dad was gritting his teeth much more than I realized as the car was lurching and we're mashing gears and doing all of that. And I think I only did that once or twice before my dad took me out towards Coburg on some back road at night because he didn't think there'd be anybody there. And we pull over, and he tells me to get in the driver's seat. And my recollection may not be accurate, but what I remember is it seems like within a minute of being behind the wheel on this back road, some sort of animal, whether it was a nutria or a possum or whatever, ran out in front of me. It might as well have been a buffalo. And I almost put the car in the ditch. That was my first driving experience. And that's what you call almost a literal crash course. It scared me to death. And now, as I was thinking about this week, my daughter's 14. And I realized very soon I'm going to be in that other seat in the car. And it kind of concerns me a bit. But how many of you have had a crash course in something, whether it's a job that you weren't trained for, or you know, you jump in a class and realize maybe there was some prerequisites I should have taken and they didn't give them to me? Or some of us, if you've had children, I remember going home from the hospital and strapping Elizabeth into this car seat and going, like, shouldn't I have passed a test or something before they let me take this child home? What do we do now? Jen was totally calm. But we have those moments in life, right, where we have these sort of crash courses where we find ourselves thrown into things that we feel perhaps ill-prepared for, and yet there we are. This morning, as we continue in Mark, we come upon what I would call a crash course in the disciples' life as disciples. This is a crash course in following Jesus, in essence. If you're with us last week, we saw in this really brief scene in Mark chapter 1 that Jesus comes along and essentially interrupts everyday life of these fishermen. We have Simon and Andrew, and then James and John, and Jesus comes along. They're in the midst of the ordinary, in the midst of their jobs, and Jesus invites them to follow him, and we have this sort of stunning scene where they leave nets, they leave boats. James and John leave their dad and the family business, and they just get up and they start following Jesus. And this morning we come across these five really brief scenes that fill out the remainder of Mark chapter 1. And as we consider them together this morning, I'm going to ask you to try to actually enter into the story and imagine what this was like for these people. And what we want to do specifically is see what we can learn about who Jesus is and the way Mark describes these events, and also to try to understand what it looks like to follow Jesus from the story of the disciples. So we have these four fishermen who follow Jesus. And the very next thing we read is this. This is Mark 1, verse 21. And this is the next scene. It says they're now following Jesus. They've left their boats. They've left everything. It says, they went to Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue, and he was teaching. So we end up in Capernaum. I want to start there. This is perhaps the very next day. Mark uses that word immediately, as I mentioned the last couple weeks. We're going to see that word a lot. He's going to be emphasizing the immediacy, oftentimes, of the power of Jesus to invade situations. So they enter the synagogue in Capernaum. So before we continue, let's just give some context to this story so we can kind of enter into the setting. So if I give you a map of Israel, down here is Jerusalem. Right next to that is Bethlehem, where Jesus is born. Up here is Nazareth. You follow the Jordan River north, and just beyond Nazareth and to the east, we come to the Sea of Galilee. And this little point up here is Capernaum. Now, the Sea of Galilee, to give you a sense of how big it is, we think sea, we think ocean. It's at its longest point north to south, about 13 miles, and its widest east to west, about 7.5 miles. And if we zoom in to the north end of the Sea of Galilee, right here is this area, Togba, where these mineral streams come in that I mentioned last week. That's likely where the disciples were, these fishermen, when Jesus calls them. just north of there, up here, is some hillsides where we're pretty certain the feeding of the 5,000, some other events took place. And then we have this little town of Capernaum right here, probably just a couple miles from Togba, where they'd been fishing. And Capernaum likely had a population of about 1,000 to 1,500. It sat on a highway that went to Damascus. We know as a result of that, apparently that was manned by a sort of customs agent slash tax collector we're about to be introduced to by the name of Levi. And we also know of Capernaum that it was at least important enough that there was stationed there a detachment of soldiers under the care and watch and leading of a centurion, a Roman soldier. But more importantly, perhaps, for us to consider in this setting, in this place, Capernaum, is that it appears to be home for Simon and Andrew and likely James and John as well. And so there they are, all together at Capernaum, likely staying at Simon's house. We're going to see that in a moment, that later they certainly are. And on the Sabbath, they go to synagogue together. Much like we're gathered together this morning in church, they would gather in the synagogue on the Sabbath in this small town. It was common, by the way, in the synagogue when a teacher is visiting to have them speak, which is likely what's taking place as we jump into this scene with Jesus speaking in the disciples' home church in their small town, if you will. Only they called it a synagogue. So then notice what happens next in this environment, basically at home, the place they would gather to worship. Jesus is teaching. In verse 22, we read, and they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. And immediately, verse 23, so probably interrupting his teaching, there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out. Try to visualize this actually happening here this morning, kind of give some life to it. He cries out, and he cries out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." Kind of awkward. But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." And then it gets more interesting. It says, "And the unclean spirit," verse 26, "convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him." And they were all amazed. It's kind of this obvious statement, right? Obviously, you're probably amazed. They're all amazed so that they question among themselves, saying, "What is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." And then verse 28, we get this little comment, "At once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee." So Jesus astonishes everyone because rather than teaching in the traditional way where you would cite sort of all your sources and Rabbi so-and-so said this or this scribe said this, Jesus just teaches on his own authority. And Mark, by the way, uses a number of different Greek terms through this passage to emphasize their amazement, their astonishment, this profound impression that Jesus is making on this audience. And in the midst of this teaching, which has everyone's attention, it frankly gets really weird. Just like it would be really weird right now if somebody jumped up and started screaming, which I didn't ask anyone to do that, just so you know. But it'd be a little uncomfortable, right? This individual jumps up and starts yelling at Jesus, asking, "Have you come to destroy us?" saying, "I know who you are, you're the Holy One of God." If you can imagine being one of the disciples at this point, you've likely brought Jesus here. This is your home place of worship. Everybody knows you. You know everybody else. And then this starts to happen. I mean, if you brought a visitor with you this morning and they got up and started yelling in the middle of service, might you feel a wee bit awkward, uncomfortable, uncertain about what's happening? And then Jesus rebukes him, as we read, and with a raised voice commands, "Be silent and come out of him." If you can imagine, now this guy who you probably know is convulsing and writhing and crying, and the spirit comes out of him. And then in a moment, it's done. Like that, can we agree that would be weird if that happened this morning? Probably memorable. And then everyone's amazed and they start asking, "What is this?" And in this moment, the news travels far and wide and begins to spread essentially like a virus that this Jesus is here, and every village begins to hear about it from now on. And things just got really crazy for these fishermen that just left their nets to follow Jesus. Like, this happened really quick. Like, did they know the person laying there convulsing and screaming? Maybe they grew up with him. They may even be related to him for all we know. There they are with their friends looking at them, wondering what is going on. There had to be tension. There had to be discomfort. All of these questions rising within the disciples. Perhaps Jesus is even frightening for them all of a sudden. This may be more than they thought they were signing on for. It likely was. And we can see clearly that this doesn't seem to bother Jesus one bit. He seems fine with all this going on. And even more interesting is that this day isn't even over yet, not even close to it. If we read on in verse 29, sort of go to this next scene, it says, immediately, there's that word again, he left the synagogue and he entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. And we read that Simon's mother-in-law lay ill with a fever. And immediately they told him about her, and he came and he took her by the hand and lifted her up, and the fever left her and she began to serve them. Again, imagine yourselves as the disciples, certainly as Simon and Andrew. And this is not just some person convulsing in the synagogue now. This is your mother-in-law who's being made well, and it's in your home, and this is all happening very quickly. They leave one crazy scene and go to Simon and Andrew's house. Interestingly enough, it should catch our attention that the mother-in-law lives with them, because one of two things has to be going on. Either her family isn't there to care for her, because it'd be normal if she's a widow to go and live with one of her sons, or if that wasn't possible, go back and live with her own family. But here she is apparently with her daughter's husband and his family. So either that's the case, which would tell us something about Simon and his compassion, or possibly, since we think Simon's originally from Bethsaida, this may be her house that they're living with her, which also raises some interesting family dynamics. But rather matter-of-factly, Jesus is told she has a fever, and he heals her of it. Now things are happening with her in their house that are awkward, uncomfortable, exciting. But Jesus isn't done. It's a Sabbath, so probably after the scene in the synagogue, everyone else went home. They were only allowed to walk so far. They were to rest. But then sundown happens, and the day continues. If we go to verse 32, because once it's sundown on Sabbath, you now are done with Sabbath. You can start moving about. And it says, that evening at sundown, they brought to him all who were sick or oppressed by demons. Interesting crowd of people. And the whole city was gathered together at the door and healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he would not permit the demons to speak because they knew him. That's all stated so matter-of-factly. Can you imagine what this was like? Can you imagine? They just said yes to following Jesus, and literally what it brings them is sick and demon-oppressed people at their front door, likely in their living room. Not the kind of people you want to invite over for dinner. This is where they find themselves. If you were to go to Capernaum, you would see that the homes were simple structures. They were made of essentially large basalt rocks, so they're really dark. You had to have a little more money to have limestone, so you had a lighthouse. There were openings that were not very tall, but wide, narrow enough that you couldn't really crawl in and get into somebody's house, but enough to let some light in. But they're dark, probably a dirt floor. They had oil lamps. This was home. The buildings were close enough together that there's probably some sort of small street out front where this crowd is gathering, pressing in towards the front door of this house. It says the whole town was there. It's likely the disciples were still processing what had happened earlier at the synagogue. Maybe in the quiet of the afternoon they thought, well, that was it for today. And then the sun goes down and all these people show up. And it's not all the elite and influential. It's all the sick and demon-oppressed at their front door. Welcome to following Jesus, right? And in their home, likely. By the way, all these people now know their address. Like, that would be really uncomfortable, wouldn't it? They know the place to go where Jesus is staying, to seek help. Just days earlier, these are simple fishermen, and now they're the ones that everyone knows are with Jesus. They had to have gone to bed with all sorts of questions and thoughts filling their exhausted brains. This certainly went late into the night if Jesus is healing all of these people. What a long, crazy day. And then it gets better. They wake up and Jesus is gone. That's how the story continues. If you read the next morning, this next scene we get, verse 35, rising very early in the morning while it was still dark, he, Jesus, departed, went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. By the way, you're going to find out Jesus does this a lot as we go through the Gospels. And Simon and those who are with him searched for him. He's gone. And they found him in verse 37 and said to him, "Everyone is looking for you." What does that tell us? There's probably still another crowd at their door. There's still people looking for Jesus. Maybe it's like they're trying to find Jesus because this scene at their house is kind of getting crazy. Verse 38, Jesus says to them, "Let us go on to the next towns, that I may preach there also, for that's why I came out." And he went throughout all Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and casting out demons. Which, by the way, probably wasn't what the disciples wanted him to do at that point. One thing that we learn immediately about Jesus is that his concern doesn't seem to be at all what people think of him or want of him, but rather doing the will of the Father, doing that which he's called to. And after this incredibly long day, here's Jesus up before everyone else, specifically to go out and to be in the solitude of prayer. And conversely, what is the concern of these brand new disciples? Everyone's looking for you. Not, "Jesus, what do you want of us?" It's this is what you're supposed to, everyone's looking for you. We need you. Get over here. This is the plan. They're likely hearing questions from neighbors and friends who want them to get Jesus back on scene. Maybe still have those who are loved ones who are sick that they're hoping Jesus will attend to next. And the disciples seem concerned not with what Jesus wants with them, but what the people want of Jesus. Maybe what they themselves want of Jesus. And the fascinating thing is, Jesus isn't at all afraid to let them down. He doesn't come back for round two. He leaves. And they go visit all these other towns and places throughout Galilee. By the way, this is going to take some time because Jesus, we're told, teaches in these other synagogues, which isn't all going to happen in a day. They're going to travel by foot. They're going to cover miles. They're kind of going to go all over the place. And remember, now their house is like the marked place back in Capernaum. There's probably still going to be crowds gathering there looking for Jesus. Like, I would be double-checking the deadbolt, right? I'd be a little nervous to leave knowing that that wake is going to be behind us. And we're not going to be there. I wonder if they wondered, I assume they wondered what they would even come home to. Like, what would it be like? These are real issues that these disciples are forced to start to face. And they're not so different than many of the issues we face as we endeavor to follow Jesus. Jesus knows his purpose. He isn't afraid to make a scene. He isn't concerned with disappointing the disciples or anyone else. He's doing the will of the Father. He's doing that which he's called to. So how do the disciples handle this mixture of excitement? And suddenly there's fame surrounding not only Jesus, but them. They're his entourage. They're the people with Jesus. There's got to be all these swirling questions. We come to one last scene in Mark 1 that I want us to consider together this morning. It's quite a fascinating scene. We actually heard it read earlier. And if you've been in the church for any period of time, this idea of lepers and Jesus healing them may not seem all that strange because we've heard the Sunday school lessons. But this is pretty intense stuff. We're going to read this in just a moment. If you want to turn there, again, it's verse 40. And I want to slow down just long enough to try to picture this scene. And I want to try to, as I read it, I want us to try to hear it through the eyes of the disciples, how they're experiencing this and imagining this. This is verse 40 of Mark chapter 1. A leper came to him, imploring him, and kneeling said to him, "If you will, you can make me clean." Moved with pity, he stretched out his hand and touched this leper, and said to him, "I will, be clean." Again, we get this word immediately, and immediately the leprosy left him and he was made clean. If you can visually imagine what this was like. And Jesus sternly charged him and sent him away at once and said to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded for a proof to them." We'll explain this in a moment. But verse 45, he apparently doesn't do that. He went out and began to talk freely about it and to spread the news so that Jesus could no longer openly enter a town, but was out in desolate places and people were coming to him from every quarter. Can you imagine this? By the way, this is, you think the synagogue was uncomfortable? This is really uncomfortable. Lepers were not allowed to freely move in public because they were considered unclean. And this wasn't just a health issue, but also an issue of religious purity. People with a whole number of skin issues were required to go before a priest, and then it was decided if they were unclean or not. And they were given instructions based on what they were afflicted with. And a leper was one who was deemed unclean ceremonially and possibly due to their condition also as a public health hazard. And so this leper is likely breaking the rules by publicly coming to Jesus in the first place. And nonetheless, Jesus heals him. And to make it more uncomfortable, Jesus doesn't just sort of do this hocus pocus from a distance. He reaches out and touches him. This had to make the disciples squirm. In fact, I wonder as I read this story if the rest of that day they're sort of at a little more distance from Jesus because they don't want to get it. They don't want to have anything to do with this. But Jesus has compassion for this one who almost certainly his disciples would have avoided at all costs. This one who's marginalized, who's overlooked. And this is a theme that's going to continue to develop in Mark. This had to make the disciples' skin crawl. This had to be like, you know, kids talking about cooties. This had to be really difficult for them. You simply don't do things like this. And yet Jesus is so powerful that instead of being made himself unclean when he touches this gentleman, he overcomes the impurity and actually heals him. That piece about sending this leper to a priest, I think was really in part about this man gaining his freedom not only from this condition on his skin, but socially as well, because he had rules basically imposed on him because of his condition, and it was only the priest who could lift those. And so Jesus sends him to this priest to be considered clean and thus get his freedom back. How uncomfortable. I keep using that word, but for Jesus to reach out and touch this person who is a threat, who you're raised to believe you're supposed to avoid, who you don't know if you could get something from them. And yet here's Jesus reaching out and touching him to heal him. And it's with immediacy. Mark's going to continue to emphasize this point. Jesus is commanding people and demons alike to stay silent about who he is, because it isn't time for it to be public yet. And what happens? The leper ignores Jesus' direction. And there's this new problem. Now they can't even go into a town. If you can imagine the crowds that must mean. Although they can't even freely walk about in a town anymore because there's so many people pursuing them. And again, if you can imagine this through the eyes of the disciples, this is right at the beginning. In fact, as we discussed last week, these disciples still really don't have any idea who Jesus is. They said yes to following him and still really don't understand what's coming at the cross at all. And they say yes, and this is what they find themselves immersed into. I wonder if we could just pause for a second and just thinking of these scenes we looked at this morning, if you want to take your bulletin and maybe just jot down your thoughts on what do you see that you learn about Jesus, and what do you see from these stories that you learn about being his disciple? Maybe you're still writing, but I'll close with a couple thoughts of my own. we see that Jesus' priority isn't what we want him to do or be, but rather it's the will of the Father. One of the things that I think we have to face into as we read the Gospels is people who seek to follow Jesus is that there will be times when Jesus will disappoint your desires. There will be times where you want Jesus to be or do something that he is not going to. It isn't just a little saying for a poster when Jesus turns to his disciples and those following him and says, if you want to find life, you're going to have to lose it for my sake. There is a sense of loss at times in the things we think we need or want as we follow Jesus. And oftentimes we're blessed enough to realize God had better things in store. But there's those moments we go through where there's a sense that Jesus will disappoint our desires. It's just reality. And as we read the Gospels and take them at face value, this happens quite often, in fact, to those who are following Jesus. We also learn that Jesus has compassion for those that we might not have compassion for. And he has patience with our hearts in the midst of it. It's interesting. Jesus just sort of lets this awkwardness happen and gives us the disciples the space to experience it for what it is, even though it's, we'll go all the way into chapter 10, 11 of Mark and see the disciples still want to overlook people that Jesus cares for, but he's patient with them. But Jesus has compassion for people that we may not want to. And part of that transformation of becoming followers of Christ and growing into his likeness is that we learn to have compassion for people we may not have wanted to before. Again, Jesus seems completely comfortable allowing his followers to be really uncomfortable. He does not seem concerned with the comfort of his disciples. He allows them to be in difficult and awkward and tense situations again and again. And at the same time, Jesus is astonishing in both his power and his authority. We don't want to overlook. These events are amazing. This is Jesus, this powerful one with authority beyond perhaps what we even want to understand and face into. And on the other side, as far as disciples, being a disciple is confusing. There's just times where it is. Again, imagine you were a fisherman, later a tax collector, no one of significance. You come from a fairly small town. You don't know much of the world beyond it. There was, of course, no internet or mail or paper phone, all that. Along comes this rabbi who's unique, who's different, who clearly has authority. He invites you to come and follow him. You leave your livelihood to do that because he chose you. Suddenly you're his entourage. You're with Jesus. All of this is happening. What does that do to you? It gives me a little more compassion because oftentimes when we get later in the Gospels and I see these guys jockeying for position and all these weird things happening, it's easy to forget, like, they were in the thick of this. They didn't understand so much. And can you imagine going from being this insignificant fisherman in a small town to now you're with the celebrity? You're perhaps seen as his right-hand man. And does that go to your head? Is that something that they were processing through maybe more than we understood? But there's this reality that being a disciple was confusing. Being a disciple created tension. Tension between following the wants of the people around you, even the people who knew you in your hometown, and the leading of Jesus. Immediately, being a disciple costs a lot. Their home is invaded. Their whole life is upended. And I think maybe this is just hard to face into, but being a disciple doesn't come with a complete set of instructions. Yes, from our vantage point, we have the scriptures, but there are a lot of situations they don't clearly speak to in black and white. There are a lot of situations where we, like the disciples, have to just wait and see where Jesus is going to lead. We don't get all the answers. We don't get full instructions for every situation. And yet, they didn't turn back. When all this is going down, they didn't say, this is too much. Never mind, I'm going to go back and start fishing again. They do have their moments of doubt, but I think the disciples understood this was the greatest opportunity of their lives. And it really is no different from us. That this invitation to follow Jesus that costs so much, that comes with questions, that can be so uncomfortable and tense and difficult, is still the greatest opportunity you and I have in this life. Jesus invites us, like these fishermen, to follow him, to come alongside him in this marvelous adventure of faith. Jesus invites us to stumble into a crash course with him, learning as we go, step by step. And I want to emphasize that following Jesus is more than agreeing that something is true. It's more than agreeing to a statement of faith. It's this ongoing journey of faith into things unknown, things which we oftentimes feel completely unprepared for. Following Jesus involves tension. It involves awkward moments. It involves fear and uncertainty and excitement and joy and surprise. This is the life we're invited into. This is supposed to continue to be the life as we continue taking steps following Jesus. And so the question for all of us this morning, and the question as we continue through the story of Mark, is really this: Jesus, what's the next step? Jesus, what's next? What do you have for me today? The beautiful thing about these stories is that even if this morning you're not somebody who would consider yourself a person of faith, you're probably more like the disciples than those who would consider themselves people of faith, because they hadn't figured a lot of things out yet. And yet where they're at, Jesus invites them to follow him. And we'll see through the Gospels that all sorts of people from all sorts of backgrounds, the invitation will be the same. Come and follow me. Come and follow me. And as we go through the story, we begin to understand more and more who Jesus is, and we finally come to the cross and understand that Jesus came not just to be a king, not just to fix a nation, but to defeat sin and to give us new life. And so wherever you are this morning on that continuum of faith, of just figuring out if you believe to the person who's believed for 30, 40 years, the question's still the same this morning. Jesus, what is the next step that you have? And probably some of those uncomfortable issues, like the disciples faced, are there for us as well this morning, because that's part of the adventure of faith. So I want to invite you, I'm going to pray. I'm going to invite you simply to ask that question and to listen today for God's leading in your lives. Father, thank you for your love for us in Christ. Thank you for not sanitizing the story, but leaving the rough edges and the rawness. Father, we ask that you would give us ears to hear your leading in our lives. Father, we pray this morning that you would give us a fresh sense of not what the whole next seven chapters of life look like, but just what's the next step. Would you give us ears to listen? Would you speak into our hearts? Would you give us direction for that next step? Father, would you give us hearts willing to respond and to follow after you? And with that, Father, we would pray that if it means turning our homes upside down, making some of our relationships uncomfortable, whatever it is, would you give us the faith to follow you in obedience? Would you give us maybe more realistic expectations, that we wouldn't seek that you would just fill all our desires? Father, you would give us a greater willingness to step into those places of discomfort, to love people who maybe we would otherwise avoid. We ask for a fresh bit of faith this morning, that we would take yet another step following Jesus. We pray this in his name.